We have been, of course, talking about biblical perspectives on relationships. Today we're getting into the relationship with the civil government, and maybe you might even say culture at large. And I thought it'd be helpful to have a whiteboard today, because we're gonna do some kind of big picture thinking first here. And most of our talk so far has been individually, how do I relate to these other institutions? And that's still where we're ultimately going to go. We might end up taking two sessions. Probably I'll take two sessions on the topic of civil government. Typically when we think about our relationship with civil government, a question that comes up a lot is how Christians and the church together relate to the civil government. And so I thought it would be helpful to actually start thinking there. How do Christians and the church together think about our relationship to both the church and the government and the church with regard to the government? And there have been several different approaches that Christians have attempted down through the ages in terms of making that relationship. And so we're going to try to talk big picture about five main viewpoints of how the church and the culture at large and the church at state and state have related, talk about what might be most biblical. The first three are clearly problematic, in my opinion. The last two, I think there's something to be said for each of the last two in some regards, and frankly, I'll suggest that there's a way in which they come pretty close together, and there's some ways that on some extremes they're pretty far apart. But let's list them, and we'll talk through. And I'm going to put some maybe names that might be a little strange at first, but then we'll talk through them. So one possible way is Christ against culture. And you could think culture, you could think state. There's going to be some crossover in this. Next one is going to be Christ of culture. And next one's going to be Christ above culture. And again, I'm going to define these, or try to do my best. And then I'm going to break the little sequence here and say the last one we'll call two kingdoms. And then the last one, transformationist. And we'll talk specifically about something called sphere sovereignty under this one as well. And of course, that's a misspelled sphere sovereignty, probably. But hopefully you can work with it. So I mentioned these three we're going to talk about are clearly problematic. In the Reformed circles, you're going to find proponents of both of these in various ways. And so I'm not going to, per se, reject out of hand either of these. In fact, I'm going to suggest some benefits in both of the viewpoints, and we can have some further dialogue after that. When we get through all of this, then we'll then step back and think about how individually now we relate to civil government, which chances are we'll just get through this today. We'll see how far we go. Okay, first one.
Are you recording this?
It is being recorded. Well, hopefully the quality comes through. First one, Christ against culture. This idea is that there's a complete rejection of culture in regards to the Christian's demand for loyalty, as try to get this to work, to the state. Maybe to get your mind thinking about this, have you guys heard of the Mennonites? What do Mennonites typically do?
They're just basically Anabaptists.
Okay, good. And I know what you mean, but I'm thinking more people know what Mennonites are than Anabaptists. Flush that out. What in terms of culture, what's unique about an Anabaptist and a Mennonite? Anyone?
They withdraw from the culture. They have their own. They just have their own isolated little community.
Exactly. So this is like separatist, radical, anti-cultural Christian separatists. We live off in our own little commune. We do things among ourselves. We try to stay away from the rest of the culture as much as possible because the culture, in some sense, is inherently bad. The culture is, in some sense, so perverted by Satan that we want to have nothing to do with it. And so we're going to start our own little Christian societies anywhere and everywhere possible that has nothing to do with the rest of the world. And so the Anabaptists in general would be like the main proponents of this. Mennonites are probably the more consistent of them. Amish would be in some regard. They might have some more interaction with culture than maybe, say, the Mennonites. But certainly we can think of some of these Anabaptist groups. Hutterites in like the Montana area. Hutterites, I've been to Hutterite Farm close to where he grew up.
So yeah.
It's not a farm, but a community. Mm-hmm. This is people trying to live apart from the culture. Questions on the general thought. I'm just kind of reviewing these in big picture so far. Any groups that might be more closer to this idea, that might be closer to home? Any application you might think about this? I kind of wonder if sometimes, without intending to be this way, we can do this with our own kids. We can, not necessarily homeschool, but maybe as a homeschooler family. That wasn't per se what I actually wanted, but...
maybe some homeschoolers.
That's right. Well, I was just thinking, well, you homeschool or not, Christians, out of a good desire to protect their kids, often want to protect their kids. And maybe we might even call shelter our kids and keep them from the wiles of the world as long as we possibly can. And you have to think that maybe there's some sense in which we're acting like that in that regard without saying that we shouldn't ought to protect our kids. And then I think even in the same way, in the Christian church, we can end up being very ingrown. So that, you know, over time, all our friends are Christians, and yeah, maybe we go out to work, but otherwise, for the most part, we're so integrated with our Christian community that we have no interaction with the world. And so flip in 1 Corinthians 5. Verse 9 through 13. This will be, I think, just one. We're just doing quick summary right now, and this would be one way I think that this view falls short of what's expressed in 1 Corinthians 5, 9 through 13. Who's got that for me?
I have it.
Go for it. You look excited to read it.
I wrote to you in my epistle not to keep company with sexually immoral people, yet I certainly did not mean with sexually immoral people of this world, or with the covetous, or extortioners, or idolaters, since you would need to go out of the world. Through 11.
Sure. 13.
But I have written to you not to keep company with anyone named a brother who is a fornicator, or covetous, or idolater, or reviler, or drunkard, or an extortioner. Not even to eat with such a person. What have I to do with judging those who are outside? Do you not judge those who are outside, who are inside? But those who are outside, God judges. Therefore, put away from yourselves that wicked person.
So the simple point here is that, as you see, they're dealing with a church discipline case, and they're saying if you've got someone who is in the church that calls himself a Christian, but is not acting like it in a very obvious way, then you ought not to pretend the problem doesn't exist. And you, gets into like the concept of shunning. The thing, though, he clarifies, he says, I don't say that you do this with everyone in the world. Otherwise, verse 10, you would have to go out of the world. The assumption there is that we are in the world. And you have to wonder how people like this, in the radical senses, can say they're actually in the world if they have so separated themselves so they try as best as they can to have nothing to do with the fornicators, covetous, idolaters, revilers of the world. That makes sense, the distinction there? So I would just right away say I think that this is an unhealthy, unbiblical extreme. We can appreciate some of the ideas, but I would not advocate it. So, okay, that's the first one. The second one, Christ of culture, they see, this is the opposite extreme. They see no great tension with Christianity and maintaining broad amounts of the culture. And maybe another way to call this is the cultural Christian, or accommodators of Christ to the culture. Let me say right now here, I think that the types of people that would fall under this, that I would think hopefully would all realize these actually really aren't Christians at all in any sort of sense.
They're carnal Christians.
Carnal Christians would be another way of putting it. It's people that say... What's that?
I was actually just kidding. That's what they would teach in, what's that one? Campus Crusade.
Ah.
They give you that little booklet and say, like...
But actually, I think that label would apply here. Because it's the people that say they're Christian, maybe think they're Christian, but have no problem doing whatever the rest of the culture is doing, and in their mind, able to rationalize it some way or another. And so there's different extremes of this. Like, in the Bible, you've got the Judaizers. What were the Judaizers? Anybody remember what the Judaizers were?
They said you had to keep the, like, Mosaic law, not only like, okay. the Ten Commandments, but all the ceremonial
stuff. Good. And so the sense in which this might apply, in the sense that these converts, so-called, of Jewish background, become Christian, and once they continue living Jewishly and everything that the Jews did, without recognizing the distinctions and the change and the transformation that becoming a Christian entailed, and then, in fact, they tried to get others, even Gentile converts, to act that same way. Of course, the Bible says that's, you know, something they spoke against in the early church. Maybe a more extreme version of this is Gnosticism. Gnosticism. Anybody remember what Gnosticism was, basically?
Selfishness.
Selfishness. From Gnosticism? So explain what you mean by that.
Like when he's conceited and just think about oneself all the time.
I think you're thinking of a different word. I'm trying to remember what word you might be thinking of. Gnosticism is... Yes, it's okay. English as a second language, you're allowed to make mistakes. Narcissist, yes, different word. Also big word.
Related in some way.
Maybe. The Gnostics, this is like in the early church, and especially like 2nd century, they wanted to take a lot of the Greek philosophy, especially things like Plato, and see that they were very closely related with Christianity. Maybe kind of like make Plato Christian, or see how Plato really was right in line with Christianity. And so what they ended up having was these Christian labels of various things that they made full of the Gnostic, pagan, Greek philosophy. And what you ended up having was something that wasn't Christian at all. But for their perspective, they were able to have, you know, some of both. And they thought it all worked out. But of course it doesn't. And that was, even in the first century, we see the New Testament already beginning to speak against the Gnostics. Like 1 John clearly is dealing against some of the Gnostic heresies of people who would say Jesus wasn't really a man. He just looked like a man, but really, because the pagan Gnostics thought flesh was bad inherently, and they thought it's the soul and the spirit that's good inherently, and so they tried to rewrite Christian teaching based on it. And then today, you might have like theological liberalism, full swing theological liberalism, that says, yeah, I can call myself a Christian. I don't actually have to believe the Bible to be historical, but I don't have to believe Jesus as presented has to be historical, but I can still benefit from these Christian teachings and see the value of them and call myself Christian and think myself Christian, belong to a mainline Christian denomination, even though you've rejected what Christians have always believed to be fundamental to the faith. And so this is, again, the idea of such people is we're just trying to be Christians in a modern era. You know, back then, that was fine, but, you know, we're wiser than that now. And so we have to, you know, understand Christianity from the progress man has made. From rationality, which doesn't believe in miracles and things like that. So that would be maybe one example of this in more modern times. Thoughts on that? Questions on that?
Oh, it was also like it didn't matter what you did with the body, because like you're spiritual and, you know, there's this big dichotomy.
In Gnosticism you're talking about? Yeah,
your body and your soul, so... with your body, basically.
Which would clearly not be biblical.
Right.
Bodies are a temple of the Lord, right? It says we ought to cherish our bodies and keep them pure. So, you know, these ideas we see coming down the line. What about in more closer circles? Do we find this at all in any more closer circles? Like I mentioned with the first one, maybe. Okay, explain that.
They get all kinds of tattoos and like pretend like they're just trying to be relevant to the culture. And
okay.
All and, this other stuff.
And that's similar to the example I had here. I said many evangelical churches seem to be making even say Sunday service more and more culturally appealing
PowerPoint
to the world around. Yeah, absolutely. And I was even thinking like one of our old church attenders, Tim Sneed, said he brought a friend to his old church who was a complete unbeliever, had very little understanding of Christianity at all. And he asked him afterward what he thought of the service, and he's like, something like, the rock concert was cool, but I really like the comedian or something like that, you know? And but isn't that very much like what they're, a lot of these evangelical services are like? It's like a rock concert, which the world is familiar with, and it's like a stand-up comedy act, you know, with a little bit of a sell the point at the end, you know, try to sell the gospel at the end somehow. So we have to really wonder if, in some sense, we have, in evangelical circles, wanted to become like the culture in order to appeal to it, and actually instead of us changing the culture toward Christ, it's actually the other way around, that the culture is changing us in ways we ought not to change. I think, if anything, we want Sunday... you know, we're out in the world all week long engaging with people. If anything, Sunday people should feel a little out of place because they are out of place if they're not on the Lord. They are outsiders looking in when they come to a worship service of God's people. And so, if anything, I think there should be a sense of feeling a little out of place and uncomfortable when they come to a service. That doesn't mean we have to make it so they can't understand what's going on. I'm not saying that. Questions on this one then? Other thoughts?
One of our previous churches, the pastor was telling a story about how several evangelical churches he knew of were actually going out into the community and asking people what they want from church and going door to door. So that was just another example.
Yeah, it might be statistically interesting to hear what people say, but I wouldn't then want to take the results and say, okay, now we're going to just cater to however people wanted it. That's what we'll do, right? We want
Starbucks in the lobby.
That's right. If we had Starbucks in the lobby, then, you know, walk in, place your order, and then sit down, you know, we'll deliver it to your chair, you know.
It's exactly like church, my parents' issue. Like, they had, like theater seats with, like, you can bring, like, in your...
Oh, really?
In your, like,
whoa.
You know.
Like, oftentimes people talk about their service, that they like their church because it's entertaining.
Yeah.
And I think that
pastor has like this, the tiny like wireless mic and like highlights in his hair, like.
We were looking at getting a mic system when we talked about getting the wireless mic because they are easier to communicate with.
And we are
not to be trendy and hip though. Yeah, the Starbucks machine is on.
It's
order,
like a TED talk. It's like you would see it. At, they try to be like a TED talk.
I see.
I've never seen one of those.
Did you say TED or TINT?
TED, it's like technology, like education.
Oh, okay.
Like, you're a really good presenter with like some great idea, which usually isn't very interesting at all. Like Al Gore, like he was invited to speak at a TED talk.
So I see.
Like,
they think the inventor of the internet would get that chance.
Right, yeah.
Sorry.
But,
bad joke.
It's a good joke.
Yeah, so trying to make it like that as much as possible.
No one laughs, though. Okay, moving along. This third one, Christ above culture. This is one that I think the wording of it isn't the greatest. So let me just explain what we're talking about. By the way, these five, at least conceptually, came from this historic book that had been written. When I say historic, like I've seen it in broad Christianity as an accurate description of the different camps. And so I'm using that in putting this together. Christ above culture, essentially what he's talking about is, and actually let me even stop and say, these two are the radical extremes. One end, completely remove yourself from culture. This one, completely immerse yourself in culture undiscerningly. And now this one is attempting to interact with culture in a way that's tempting to think biblically, to not have either of the two extremes. That being said, I think you'll find as we talk about it, this one is riddled with difficulties and problems. And these last two, I think, are more healthier expressions of what this one might be trying to accomplish. Christ above culture, you might think of, for this example, as most of Christianity during the Middle Ages, where you had Christendom from a geopolitical sense, that the church and therefore Christ in the church and through the church leaders is above culture in the sense that organizationally the world should strive for a situation where civil governments are under under Christ, which sounds great, fine, but therefore under the church and under therefore the church leaders. And if you're in Roman Catholic thinking, under the Pope. And then the Pope essentially is the leader of the known world. So this is that sense of Christ above culture. There becomes essentially here a unity between Christ, the church, and the state, the states of the world, with Christ being on top, and therefore the leaders of the church being on top. There's a sense in which this sounds great, because we do know God is in control over all, right? That Christ is above all, so we can appreciate that. But I think the problem with this is it's over-realized in terms of our eschatology. See, when does this actually happen, ultimately speaking?
Day of Judgment.
The Day of Judgment, right? That's when Christ comes down and ushers in the consummated kingdom, and every knee will bow, every tongue will confess, and the wicked will be cast out, and the God's people will be with the Lord forever. And essentially what they want is that here and now, heaven on earth, here and now. And I mean, we have to think about how can we really expect that to really be realized with a world full of unbelievers, unregenerate people, to submit and live in a way consistent with Christian thinking. Now, oh, sorry. Making sure I'm not missing something. Okay, so we have this hope for something like this. But we also realize that it doesn't come in its fullness until Christ comes back. Can anybody think of any movements today that might sound at all like that one?
Well, the Muslim world.
Okay.
If the Christian world was as dedicated or as controlling as the Muslim world, then it seems that when you don't have a Christian covering or whatever, then you have, then anything goes. And it's just this, kind of what's happening in our country today, everything's just sort of fluttering away. And but the Muslim world seems to be getting more aggressive and kind of more controlling, and so it's kind of pushing into areas where there's a void, and now they're pushing in.
From outside Christianity, the Muslims are very much trying to accomplish this. And in many ways, in different places of the world, they have that, effectively. That's a good example. What about within Christianity? Any movements?
It almost sounds post-mill to me.
Well, it's interesting. I think post-mill people will try to put themselves down here.
Okay.
But I wrote down on my list. I wrote on my list, though post-mill, and I wrote theonomy, might put themselves down here. Sometimes you have to wonder if it's not a fair critique if they're really not up here. And maybe you'll find that there is some overlap in all three of these categories, and maybe there's some overlap with this one up here. So, yeah, I think that's a fair question. I think about this, like a lot of the social justice emphasis in movement. I don't think that social justice movement and a lot of churches would per se describe themselves this way. But in some sense, are they trying to get sort of heaven on earth here and now? I think we were mentioning N.T. Wright's kind of some of the stuff between N.T. Wright. Emerging church sometimes, that sort of focus on let's make heaven on earth here and now. Again, I think there's some aspect in which, you know, they might want to put themselves in this category. I think we should certainly think that way. Liberation theology is this idea, like, let's have the church focus on overthrowing every sort of human trafficking and enslavement of people in this life, and that's the work of the church, and you can't help but see some tendencies in that regard as well. So any other questions on Christ above culture category? I see you laughing.
Yes, that means I'm talking
restriction
now.
Oh, yeah. Good job. the last two, like I said, I think I have a lot of positive things to say in regards to both these categories, with some extremes on both that I would want to mitigate against. Two Kingdoms, just to give you a sense, I'll just mention that a lot of Lutherans would generally fall into this. There are also a number of Reformers that would follow this, and for example, my own seminary that I graduated from, most of the faculty would identify themselves in one shape or another with this, though there are some guys on the faculty that would identify themselves on this one. Let's think about first the two kingdoms here, and maybe one way to think about it first is this one is going to think more in terms of almost like one kingdom. There's one kingdom that Christ is above all, and we want to transform that one kingdom so that Christ's kingship is present, reigning in every way possible in that one kingdom, Christ being above it all. The two-kingdom idea is to say that there are basically two kingdoms in this life at this time that you can identify. One would be the, and this is maybe putting simplistic terms at this point, what we might find in the Gospels when Jesus talks about the kingdom of God or the kingdom of heaven, or you could even just talk about Christ's kingdom. That's something, right, that he says is imminently at hand, that Christians want to enter into, and that we enter into it through Christ. And so we talk about that as one kingdom. And then the other kingdom, it says two kingdoms, is, more broadly speaking, the kingdoms of this world, the kingdoms of men and the culture of this world at large. And it's important to think about those two kingdoms because the Christian obviously would not, or not obviously, but in these two kingdoms would not say that the kingdoms of this men, so one of, the, of these two kingdoms, would not say that that kingdom has nothing of value in it or no good purpose, but it would also acknowledge there's sin throughout it, that Satan has been at work and perverting the kingdoms of this men, or of this world, the kingdoms of men. But let's talk about the two kingdoms that come out here. Why don't we just even put, for sake of here, we'll say kingdom of heaven and kingdom of man. We'll just, for sake of talking about it. In terms of the kingdom of men, it's ran by civil governments who, biblically speaking, answers to God. Actually, let me back up here and say that in the two kingdoms idea, both of these kingdoms, both of these realms, answer to God. Both of them God is sovereign over. It's not like God is only sovereign over here and he wished he could be in control of this. God is in control of both in the two kingdoms thing. Does everyone get that? Both of these are legitimate spheres or realms in this world in the sense of legitimacy in that God has established them and he has a purpose for them. Does that make sense? Okay, now in the kingdoms of men, we find civil governments that are ruling over these. And we'll look at passages probably next week that show that God is the one who has established civil governments and authorities. It does not mean that those civil governments that have been established actually serve God the way they ought. As we'll talk about this, we'll realize that's a problem. Where sin is perverting what ought to be. Kingdom of men, what we know with certainty they have is general revelation. We'll look at Romans 1 today. That everybody in this kingdom of men know there's a God deep down inside because they can tell it through the creation, even if they suppress that truth in sin. They also have what we call natural law. The natural law is God's one moral law written on the heart of men. And so every natural man has that, and therefore they're without excuse. No one can say they didn't really know that this was wrong, that they didn't know that there was a God. So natural law is in there. And in theory, many good things can happen in the kingdom of men. Think about it at the very beginning, the cultural mandate. Go and fill the earth, subdue it, be fruitful and multiply. This was created to be a place, in some sense, where good things can happen. But on the other hand, think of the Tower of Babel. This is also the place where man tried to usurp God's authority and put himself above God. And so it's a realm characterized by disobedience, rebellion against God, and yet, right now, it's upheld by God's providence. In other words, God has not wiped this out yet. Think of Noah's flood. That started to wipe that out, but it wasn't the final judgment. Sodom and Gomorrah, signs of final judgment. And yet, as I mention those, we all know then, is this going to last forever?
No.
No, it is going to have a day where it is come in final day of judgment. That's what Walt pointed out earlier in Christ coming back. So this is temporary. Temporary. And so we have to think, why has God let it be here with this rebellion? Well, if God in His providence did not allow this to happen, how could Genesis 3:15 be fulfilled, which says there will be a seed of the woman who would come and crush the head of the serpent? See, God has allowed this kingdom to survive so that the promised Messiah could come and bring about redemption, bringing a people to Himself who ought not to be on their own merits. And now it's the gospel going out, Great Commission, and spreading to the ends of the earth. And that's why God has maintained this kingdom of man right now, so that this could happen. That makes sense? Dennis.
Yeah, as I was mentioning in our prayer thing earlier, this book I was reading and talking mm-hmm. about that, and they said up to 100 years ago, the kingdom of heaven concept was prevalent. It was the way to, that this was God's realm. Mm. Then it flipped, and it became that this was Satan's realm, and God, the sovereign king, had lifted His hand off, and that we just had to hang on down here until we could get out of here and get to heaven. Mm. And it said it changes the way that you perceive your mission here and what it is to have, help somebody reach out to the world around us and try to lead, you know, tell people about Christ, have the Holy Spirit. It changes fundamentally your viewpoint on that.
Yeah.
And it's so true.
Yeah, and so hopefully this is beginning to be a more balanced biblical view and way of thinking about it. Because in contrast to the kingdom of man, you've got the kingdom of heaven. It's what we've been come into as Christians, right? This is the kingdom Jesus talked about on earth over and over. And if this one's temporary, this one's eternal. This one is experienced in an already sense, but not yet in its fullest sense. Otherwise, Revelation at the end of the new heavens, new earth, where there'll be no more pain and sorrow, where God will dwell with His people, there will be no temple, because God and the Lamb will be there. That's what we'd be in right now, but we're not in there right now. So we taste it already, but not in its fullness yet. This is the place of redemption, of special revelation, meaning that we who are in here have received that special revelation and rejoice in it and look to live by the revealed moral law of God with God's help. And it's expressed on this world. How is it expressed in this world? How do we see the kingdom of heaven expressed in this world?
Church.
The church, that's right. The visible church imperfectly expresses the kingdom of heaven on this world. I say imperfectly in the sense that in the visible church there are some who are not really Christian. But if we want to know how that is expressed and manifested, Christ is reigning through His church by His word and spirit and using the people of God to advance the cause of the kingdom and the great commission of the gospel on this world. And so that instantly tells us, or begins to tell us, that the Christian then is in this kingdom and right now in this kingdom as well. We're in two kingdoms. We are in two kingdoms. In but not of the world. If we just in this one, we could end up like up here, right? Christ against culture. But no, we're in both right now. And so Christians are doing work in both realms. And so then, maybe simplistically to think about, a Christian, when he, say, finds himself specifically at church, he recognizes he's serving in this role of the work of the church, which is primarily the Great Commission and bringing the gospel, and not per se that the work of the church is to make this world a better place by making more hospitals and soup kitchens and that type of thing, but to preach the gospel and to do diaconal ministry, especially particularly among its members, and help them in that regard. But then we also find ourselves in the kingdom of men. And as Christians in this world, hopefully we're going to make a difference. Hopefully we're going to be involved and seeing that this is has a legitimacy in it, that we ought to love our neighbors, that we ought to recognize we're involved as Christians in a democracy or a republic in some sense, that we have an opportunity to participate in the civil government, and that we have obligations there under that, and so we look to live that out, and we're going to flesh out next week more of what that might look like. But at the same time, when you're in this as a Christian, hopefully you have a realistic sense to say that this is temporary, that heaven on earth will not be, according to the Bible, achieved through me just loving my neighbor well enough and fighting against every social injustice. It's not to say we ought not to in opportunities to help relieve the sufferings of those around us. It's not to say that. But it's to say that we also need to have a realism that Jesus says there will be wars and rumors of wars up until the end. In this realm, there will be wars and rumors of wars up until the end. And we ought to have our theology influence that. And so I think an all-middle versus a post-middle especially keeps that in mind on this viewpoint. Questions on this? Checking my time.
I think through the Mennonites, they put out this Christian-like publication. They put out books, literature. And everything I've ever read that they put out is not saying be a Mennonite. They're just so Christ-centered. And they're missionaries around the world, and they're doing these different things. And yet, when I read their things, they've cleared away a lot of the garbage. Mm-hmm. And they've just, their life seems to just, it's Christ. Mm-hmm. In their interactions with each other, parents to children, with neighbors, with the community around them. And I just have this, I've never had this sense that they're like cut off from, that they're against culture. To me, they're like engaging culture, and they're like trying to do that thing where they're above culture. They're trying to reach out and just say, almost like just by example, live for Christ. You know? So I don't know.
I'm not prepared to get into detail Mennonite defense or rejection. Yeah. Just to say that historically the Anabaptists have been the groups that have gone and started their own little walled cities and didn't want anyone who was not a confessing Anabaptist into their city, or they might even put people to death who were otherwise. Mm-hmm. I'm not prepared to engage more Mennonites other than that, and you probably have engaged more with modern-day Mennonites more than I have.
I don't really know about Mennonite stuff, but I mean just their literature. I
gotcha.
Read their stuff. So.
Well, it's great if they're trying to communicate to the culture. That's great.
Yeah.
I see another question here. Okay, we got just a few minutes here, so I want to just introduce this last one, and then we'll revisit and keep going next week. But this last one can be a very broad one, and by mentioning it last doesn't necessarily mean I'm saying that this is the best one. As I mentioned, I think there's strength in here, and in many ways I lean toward this. We'll talk about that. The transformationist idea is to say that, yes, there is a difference between, say, the church and the state. There is a difference between that, and they've got different, it's a different institution, different responsibilities, but the transformationists say the Christian ought to look to transform wherever he finds himself with Christ and his Christian principles. They often might quote something like 2 Corinthians 10:4, it says, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. And so one Reformed thinker on this, Abraham Kuyper, proposed this idea of spear sovereignty, which says that what you have is the state, you've got society, and you have the church, and that each of these are legitimate, distinct spheres in which ultimately we would love to see Christ at the head and leading each of these, but at the same time that the state should not tell the church what to do, and the church should not tell the state what to do in terms of, like, coercion and enforcing. That's not to say they can't have dialogue back and forth. And then under society, they would break that up further, like family would be a big one under society, the arts and the sciences and different community groups and things like that, that within society there are different subgroups that have individual sovereignty in their own ways. And to respect the sovereignty of each of these and to begin to think about how they may interact. But the idea is that as Christians, wherever we find ourselves, to look to transform these into essentially Christian institutions. So to see Christian states and Christian hospitals, potentially Christian political parties, Christian wherever you can, make it Christian. Even though you respect the individual roles of each of this, the church has certain things the church is supposed to do, and that doesn't include the things that the state are supposed to do, and the state has certain things the state's supposed to do, not the church. And so keeping the individual sovereignty of each of those spheres. What we'll do is, since we're out of time, is next week we will take these two, I'll quickly summarize them again, and we'll look at some passages that analyze about these, and I'll make some suggestions on how we might think of one versus the other if we incline one more or the other. But what I will say is that I think two kingdoms held in a certain way and Kuyperian sphere sovereignty held in a certain way can be not that far off. In fact, my teacher, Dave Van Drunen, made the case that Kuyper had a lot of two kingdom ideas in him, and that given enough time, he would have been a two kingdom guy. and as I look at it, I see there are some unhealthy extremes to two kingdom guys, in that sometimes the two kingdom guys tend to sound like one kingdom guys. That they so acknowledge these, but they really only spend their time in the kingdom of heaven side and have very little to do in how we can make a difference in the kingdom of man in terms of many things. And then the transformationists, they on an unhealthy extreme can tend to be essentially what you have up here, which is let's just try to make this world Christian, but we have to realize how we make the world Christian is by the gospel. It's not just by forcing institutions that if you don't acknowledge this, then you're not going to be able to participate in society or something like that. So we'll dig into that more next week and try to think about some balance here. And then we'll get into more scriptures and talk about individually how we begin to live some of this out. So any last questions before we close?
Well, it's just the huge thing today about church and state. You must not have anything to do with anything with Christ, anything with God. In the state, It's all got to be separate. As if that's some entity of its own that it can just stand on its own without that any basis like that.
And that's something we'll definitely be dealing with more, because that's at the heart of some of the discussion between the two. What does that look like? You know, in what way do we interact and what we don't? And the reform people have not agreed on exactly what that looks like, but it's a healthy dialogue and discussion, and hopefully we'll get a chance to deal with that more next week. Because I think there is a way that we're in but not of this world, and we should make a difference. And we'll talk about what that looks like, at least to make some suggestions on it. Any final comments? We're out of time. We better close.